Just have to make sure Caro knows what's going on.
Hello, hello.
Caro, you know we're not on the show this week, right? Anita's in Chicago with Ashley and Angelica Bastien, who are, granted, both awesome. But I'm just going to kick my feet up and listen along with the rest of our millions of fans. Millions of fans, I said. I wonder if there's something our producer can do to get me on the show this week.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode number 10. I am your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and have I got a treat for you this week. My usual ragtag team of misfits have the week off because I'm in Chicago, and I am joined by two very special guests. Our very own Ashley Fellows.
Hello, folks.
And film critic Angelica Jade Bastien.
Hello.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. Or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to travel back in time to the 90s and get into I, Tonya, the biopic about figure skating superstar Tonya Harding. We're going to discuss how the Me Too and Time's Up movement will affect the creative side of Hollywood. And then we'll wrap up with each of us sharing a little something in What's Your Deal, or What's Your Freak Out, or What's Your Freak Out Deal, whatever we're calling it this week. And as always, exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we will be recording a bonus segment. I'm pretty excited about this week's bonus segment because we'll be sharing an interview with our lovely guest, Angelica Jade Bastien. If you want to hear this interview and get access to all of our wonderful bonus episodes, head on over to d.rip/femfreak and become a member today. Big, big thanks to Cards Against Humanity for the recording space today and to Alex Cox for the engineering support. Now, let's get on with the show. Angelica, we are so excited to have you. You are our very first guest on Feminist Frequency Radio.
Ooh.
So no pressure or anything.
Sorry in advance.
Just to let people know who you are a Southern-born critic and essayist. You're a staff writer at Vulture, specializing in film, television, and comics. It's really weird to be like, you are doing these things when you're standing in front of me. So this was a bad choice on my part. But you've written for all kinds of places, like the New York Times and the Atlantic and Rolling Stone. And you have a cat, which is my favorite part of your bio. You have two cats.
Two wonderful cats.
What are they named?
Professor Butch Cassidy and Paul Newman.
That is
amazing.
Amazing. So good. Can we for a minute talk about how Chicago weather is super bizarre right now? When I got here, it was like minus 20 degrees, and today it's like 11.
Yeah.
This is Celsius. Sorry, Americans.
Oh, yeah. What is that?
I
don't know. But I do know it was so cold. And actually, I want to make a note that the last time I recorded a podcast, it was about high 50s as well, which was bizarre, and I was complaining about that. It is now high 50s again, and I am no longer complaining. After a week of 5-degree weather, I am like, bring on the 50 degrees.
Yeah. And you just moved to Chicago. You've only been here for a bit, right, Ashley?
Yeah.
How long have you been here?
I have been here. This year marks 11 years in Chicago.
Damn.
For me.
Wow. So you're like, really? You're
I'm a Chicagoan.
Chicagoan. I was like, what do you call you people?
Chicagoans.
Chicagoan. That was a very uncomfortably loaded way of saying that. Sorry. So I'm going to awkwardly move on to the, next segment.
Let us.
I have had very little sleep this weekend, so I'm just going to say that to everyone. Our Star Trek podcast that I do with Ebony last night, I hated the show so much that it wasn't even funny. Like, I was just like, I hate it. So hopefully we will be a little more upbeat on this. Okay, so the first thing we want to talk about this week is I, Tonya. Now, when Ashley told me that this movie was being made, I lost my shit. We were so excited that we actually postponed talking about this movie so that we could be in the same room together.
Wow.
Doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Anita, let's not bury the lead. Let's give the people what they want. Why do you love figure skating?
So I figure skated as a child.
Yes.
I wore silly little homemade knit sweaters that my mom made. I wasn't very good. It was one of the things I stuck with the longest. But I do have like really fond memories of sitting around with my mom watching figure skating, especially the Olympics. So, you know, I was a kid when the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing happened. Like it's a part of the cultural, my cultural memory as a child, but I didn't know the details as well. Like, you know that you know the names and you know generally what happened, but like as when you get older, it's kind of like when all the stuff with OJ came out, like the documentary and the mini series that came out. You're like, oh, all of these details. I didn't understand the racial components when I was young, and it was just this story that went on for fucking ever. Mm-hmm. And I feel that way about this as well, right? About the figure skating aspect, where it was this big news story, and it put figure skating kind of on the map in a lot of ways. But being able to break apart like the humans behind it and the stories behind it, I think, are really interesting. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
What did you think, Angelica?
Well, my mother figure skated as a child.
Really?
And so I've always had a fondness for figure skating, even though I suck at it and should not be allowed on the ice. And so I've always found Tonya Harding very interesting, especially kind of recognizing even as a kid the way she was kind of coded differently. Even if I couldn't put it into words, it was pretty much she's a lesson in how you should not be as a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she didn't sand off her rough edges. She didn't hide the fact that she came from being a working class, poor background. And I think that's why I've always had a fondness for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though she is a fascinating woman and complex in ways that I wouldn't necessarily want to be in the same room with her.
Right. She's not exactly likable, but but fascinating, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel like, so that's what's so interesting, I think, about this movie.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Soylent Green is people.
Like, people entering into it being like, oh, I already know this story. Like, I'm well familiar with the fact that, you know, there was, like, this incident with kneecaps, whatever, Tonya Harding, Jeff Galooly, bad mustache. Like, people know all those things. But then you go to see the movie, and you really do get, like, a portrait of a very complex human being who came to be the way that she was and came to embrace fame and or lose it in that manner because of her upbringing, because of this intergenerational poverty, violence, all of these factors, which I feel like when I was watching the Olympics back in, you know, when did this happen? 94, 92? Yeah. Like, not on my mind. I was pretty jazzed about the sparkly costumes and I was like right. loving the fact that it was like all these figure skaters. And also, I was really into Oksana Baiul, who also had a very fascinating story. I don't know if you guys remember that.
I remember her being – she was mentioned in the movie. And I was like, oh, I remember that name. I have no idea who she is. But, yeah.
What?
I don't remember.
But Tonya Harding, I mean, I think the movie in a way that doesn't romanticize any aspect of her poverty or her experiences does a really good job of portraying it in a way that is also, I think it's really real, but at the same time, I think kind of compassionate. I don't know.
Well, I was just going to say it's sort of a fascinating film to sort of watch the conversations happening around it. It's probably been one of the more divisive films of this award season, which sort of surprised me when I came in to the press screening, which was months ago, like before the conversation really heated up. I was expecting not to like it because I thought the casting was just strange.
Sure.
The way Margot Robbie moves and looks typically as an actress, you would think she'd play more of a Nancy Kerrigan role than a Tonya Harding. She basically looks like a very tall blonde gazelle or something, you know? Yeah. When I was watching the film in the press screening, I really fell in love with the tone and its sort of relationship with camp, because I have a very love-hate relationship with camp, because I think sometimes that label ends up being used to describe a lot of female-led work, even though it doesn't actually fit. But just because women are larger than life, it ends up getting this camp label.
Yeah.
And so there's specifically been a lot of really interesting conversations I've had with other queer critics about Tonya Harding as an icon, and also how the film plays around with camp. I think it's purposely sort of thumbing its nose at camp. Like, it's saying, you know, this is the camp figure you think she is, and this is who she really is, but we're also smart enough to realize the issues within her and not completely act like she's a victim in every aspect of her life, which is a hard thing to balance, and I think that's why the conversations are so intense around the film. I think it's also intense because the film makes a very interesting decision to not have Nancy Kerrigan play a major role, which I think makes sense. And I'm curious as what you guys think about it.
One of the things that I liked about this film is that it really centers trauma and abuse. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's telling the story of a figure that we all know and have demonized and ridiculed for years, and trying to it is making her sympathetic, but it's also exposing how trauma begets trauma begets trauma, mm-hmm. and how it just compounds in life. And so the lines about how, you know, like her mother was abusive and then she was in an abusive relationship, which she, spoilers, we should throw up a spoiler alert now, which she then finally left, and then how to come back to in order to go to the Olympics to have judges take her seriously. And then you have the media whirlwind and the abuse. And I love that they specifically said that. So to me, I don't really, it doesn't, I know that Nancy Kerrigan is quote unquote the victim in this situation, but I don't think that that's important to this story because it is the story about abuse, really, right? It's about fame, abuse, about like, you know, it's about class. It's, there's so many aspects to it that I didn't really think about that because I didn't feel like it was missing because it's not about her.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I had a conversation with Ira Madison, who writes at the Daily Beast, and he hated the film. I loved it. And when he was in town, we talked a little bit about it. And he thought it was a really big mistake to leave out Nancy Kerrigan. Like, how do you tell the story of Tonya Harding without bringing in Nancy and how they were sort of juxtaposed to one another, especially in the press? And my whole thought with the film, I think it works with not having Nancy in it because it's so much about how Tonya looks at herself specifically. And I feel like the only issues I've had with the film is when it veers too far from her perspective because she's the best anchor for everything. So for me, it makes sense that a woman like this, in retelling her story, because they have the whole meta constraint of these interviews with different people years after the fact, and it makes sense to me that she would kind of downplay Nancy in her life and focus so much on her own relationship with victimhood and abuse. And also, one thing I think the film really nails, specifically Margot Robbie's performance, is Tonya's relationship to lying is very interesting.
Yes.
And, you know, even though Margot Robbie said that she was trying not to do a complete translation of how Tonya Harding really is, she wanted to have her own kind of space to experiment as an actress, she does really get how that woman lies and like just how her body sort of changes when she lies, and she can't help but like have a little smirk on her face. And so hearing her talk about Nancy in the movie, I was like, it totally makes sense Nancy isn't a big part of it, because to her, Nancy is inconsequential. She's the real victim. So of course, Nancy's story would be kind of like a very small part of it.
And like Nancy is definitely a victim. I don't know why I said quote unquote. Like she was, obviously. I think that just in the context of this, that this is not her story. But about the lying thing, one of the things that is fascinating about this film is how everybody is an unreliable narrator, and that that is the key to the film, is that you, I think that there are moments where you get sucked in and you really like believe what this movie is telling you. But at the end of it, I was like, wait a minute, but I don't know. I don't actually know what people thought or did. Did she have something to do with it, and that the story is being told a different way? And I think because they show these moments of interviews with Tonya where she's like, you see her lying, right? And you see her actually saying these things where she admits to doing that. It kind of puts into question the entire film and the entire narration and story of it. I also thought, I thought this was an incredible film. Like the filmmaking in it, I haven't walked out of a theater being like, I think that every, almost every aspect of this film was so beautifully intentionally crafted. Like the people on this crew knew exactly what they were doing and they killed it. And everything from like the typography to the shots to the way that they played all of it. And it's interesting that you're talking about the campiness because I didn't register that, but that's totally a piece of the way they told the story that worked so well for the tone that they were trying to get. And you know, the couple of moments where they cut into, where they like break the fourth wall and like talk to the, and it only happens a couple of times. So usually that would be a really jarring effect that I would say doesn't really work. But in here, it totally did what they needed it to do.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I just, I wanted to also just like mention one more thing about like Angelica, when you were mentioning like the way the media juxtaposed Nancy and Tanya as being these polar opposites, whatever. I think the film, by not focusing on Nancy, really avoids reinscribing those polarities. Because I think they mention her just as much as they need to in two specific moments, like one showing her and Tanya hanging out as sort of younger skaters and breaking a little bit of that narrative of Nancy being this perfect, you know, all-American individual. And then also, obviously, when she got hit. But it just reminds me of that really interesting part when I think it's Bobby, what is his last name? Cannavale?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Who plays that hard copy producer.
Yeah.
His hair is hilarious.
So good. Yeah, I was like, wait, is that? It sure is.
like,
interesting choice. Yeah. But he mentions at one point that this story coincided with the start of the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
And so the way that the media was just able to feed off of this like existing norm and then like reaffirm them and reassert them over and over and over again through these two women. And so I thought that the movie, by just stepping out of that and focusing on just one of them, really avoided that binary really nicely. For me,
I had a couple of issues that came up. I thought they were too sympathetic to Galuli. By the end of it, you kind of feel bad for him, and I don't think we should feel bad for him. Like he was a total piece of shit, like super abusive, and like he got in with these dudes who are doing ridiculous, absurd things, and he's like, you know, just maybe an inch smarter than them, like by barely anything.
Barely, yeah.
Right? And so by the end of it, you're like, you do, like you see him freaking out about how like they screwed up everything and this wasn't the plan and they just wanted to send threats, as if just sending threats isn't fucking horrifying to begin with, right?
Right.
And so that was one thing I really felt was an issue. The other one was, who's the guy, the friend who...
Sean.
So I thought that one, there was a lot of fat shaming going on in the film. And like, I struggled a little bit with, I thought there was fat shaming happening. And one of the problems is, I thought it was really frustrating because the audience I watched this with laughed at two moments that made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. One of them was, I think someone called Tanya the C word. And the audience laughed at that, and I cringed. And then when Sean, the interview with him, when he talked about being like a computer terrorism expert or a counterterrorism expert and all this stuff, I was like, I feel like we're ridiculing this guy who is clearly not well, right? Mm-hmm. Who is kind of a little bit like disconnected from reality. And then there's the fat shaming with him eating all the time. Mm-hmm. And then they're in a strip club because of course they have to be in a fucking strip club because that's how you show that misogynists are misogynists in movies.
Yeah, of course.
It was difficult for me because at the end they show the video where he really does say that. Like that was not an exaggeration, that this character is really based on reality. But there were pieces of it that I think could have been done differently. And so then that gets me thinking about like, does this film fetishize poverty, right? That some films create this sort of like where you gawk at, right? Where you look through, like, was it, and this is a sincere question because I haven't quite worked this out yet. Is it just I'm showing this particular class and this particular lifestyle in order to give the full context of this woman's life and what has happened around her and why the judges were constantly dismissing her, which was a really critical, important part of the film. To her freaking out at the judges, I like that they showed that, and they showed it sympathetically, because you're like, oh my God, don't do that. Like, act proper so that you're taken seriously. But the whole point is that is not how it's supposed to be. She's an incredible performer. So there's a bit of me that's kind of like, depending on who the audience is and where they're coming from, like, is it exposing and showing and demonstrating in a sort of educational way poverty and class or working class backgrounds? Or is it like, look at that show that we're putting on, if that makes sense?
Well, as someone who grew up working class, I thought it was just showing that. And for me, I don't think films need to necessarily be educational about poverty. Because no matter how educational you get, there's going to be audiences who look at people who are struggling and find joy in little things like Dove bars lesser than and a joke.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't experience that with the audience I saw it with, but a friend of mine who hated the film, Lindsay Romaine, who's also a critic, she noticed that they laughed at a lot of moments that dealt with poverty and the abuse, and that caused her to have a lot of issues with the film.
Yeah.
For me, I thought the film, I appreciated that, one, these weren't like noble poor people who struggling valiantly, because guess what? You can be a shit person and struggle too. You know, that doesn't mean you don't deserve to have some sense of humanity. I think my issue when it came to the Sean character was more so that I don't think the film needed him as much as it has him in there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it gets, that's where the tone gets a little weird. I even noticed like I didn't even think of it as fat shaming, but it was just like sort of heightening how grotesque he was. Mm-hmm. And there was something about that that just didn't sit right, because it keeps veering from Tanya's perspective. And he just seems like so much of a joke that it kind of veered away from what was working with the film for me. And so I think, you know, I know you said earlier, Anita, that you felt like everyone who made the film, like there was a lot of craft put in. I had an issue with the film because I feel there's sometimes a sloppiness to it narratively.
Okay.
And it comes down to the Sean character, who I think is important, obviously, for very obvious reasons to the narrative. But whenever this film veers too far away from Tanya, it veers too far away from what is working best. And I think a more even-handed portrayal of poverty. And yes, these characters in a lot of ways are larger than life and they do some grotesque shit.
Yeah.
But you have to be sort of even-handed with it. Otherwise, you do fall into the trap of making them camp figures who are jokes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I thought it got poverty really well, actually. I was surprised how well I thought it got poverty and portrayed that in a way that I really connected with and like saw a bit of myself in. But my issue with the film overall is actually Allison Janney's performance.
Really?
What? I know.
That is a decisive comment.
My unpopular opinion with this is, on one hand, I kind of love just how harsh she is and the bitchiness, but the scene with the knife is where I soured, because it felt too much like a joke. That's the one moment when people were like, I think it's making poverty and abuse a joke, where it's that moment where I think the film loses its grasp on these ideas. So in the film, basically, she's having an argument. Tanya and her mother, LaVanya, played by Allison Janney, are having an argument. And I don't remember what the dialogue is at that moment, but LaVanya throws a knife that does get into Tanya's arm.
Yeah.
And it's just such a, like, the way it's shot and the humor level is just kind of contradicts just how violent that is. Like, your mother legit threw a knife at you, so she knew there was a chance of it stabbing you. And it was just something about that moment really bothered me. And I feel my problem with Allison Janney's performance is it's a bit too broad for me. And I feel like with these larger-than-life characters, I always go back to Bette Davis, who is one of my favorite actors of all time. And she often played these really larger-than-life, often very terrible women who did a lot of fucked-up shit. And so she had to find the humanity within these characters and give some nuance to the performance. But Allison Janney is great at hitting these big notes and like really relishing like these lines and like kind of cursing at kids while she, you know, watching Tanya on the ice and drinking and smoking without giving a damn about anything. And the woman is really like that. But there was a lack of nuance to it that sort of bugged me, and I wanted it to kind of bring more levels or layers to the relationship she had with Tanya. And I just didn't feel, I don't know if it's, it may be a mix of my issues with the writing.
Yeah.
Than her performance, because I think she's a great actress.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that knife scene in particular, because I was watching, in my deep dive into Tanya Harding recently, I was watching a Truth and Lies on, I think it's ABC, and they were interviewing Tanya, and she stage by stage retells that story exactly as is.
Interesting.
And she does it in that same deadpan way that Margot Robbie does it, in this sort of like slight smirk, you know, just like talking about the this incredibly violent event just like it was nothing, like it was, you know, just like your normal Tuesday. And so I thought that was, you know, if that's like the part of the film that stood out as being like sort of like incongruent and yet oddly something that actually happened. It just,
yeah, maybe they're reflecting the way that she is thinking about it now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Or that the sort of normalcy of this kind of abuse in the space. But yeah. but I totally get what you're saying.
Totally.
I guess I also I'm probably not going to speak well to this, but it's bringing me back to the camp part of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like that I think that Allison Janney's character and performance contributed a lot to the sort of campy style. Mm-hmm. But that you might disagree with. I mean, it sounds like you didn't like her performance quite as much, or that.
No, I didn't like her performance quite as much because I felt, at least with Margot Robbie's performance, there was like this interesting balance between knowing it was like knowing the campy aspects that existed within this narrative and could easily be played up, mm-hmm. and then also giving quieter moments or like sometimes underplaying stuff in an interesting way to give sort of balance and different yeah. levels, so to speak, to her character. With Allison Janney's performance, it's legitimately to me like pretty much one note, mm-hmm. and that one note can. There's been sometimes performances like that will work for me, but something about this one just kind of grated on me after yeah. a while. Even though there was a lot I liked about it, but something about it just didn't work perfectly for me. I think especially that came up with scenes she had with Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I definitely think, you know, Allison Janney's an amazing actress. But
sure.
So I think it may be more so, you know, her... I think it's less Allison Janney, you know, messing up or something as an actor than issues with the writing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I yeah. think that's my problem with it.
Yeah. If yeah. And just one more thing, if we have to say one last thing on iTanya, I just want to say that soundtrack was A+. Like, dude, I was so in it to win it.
It was really good. And actually, The Passenger is one of my all-time favorite songs. And I've listened to, like, every cover of that song ever.
Yeah.
And so I was, like, sitting there being like, I love this movie. And now they're playing this song that I love. And it's just the best thing in the whole world.
I have a deep love for Fleetwood Mac. And they made a prominent, you yeah. know, prominent performance.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of abuse.
Good one. Yeah.
Do you like that transition? Yeah. I'm terrible at transitions. And so I feel like that one sort of worked if I didn't stop. But okay, so Me Too and the Time's Up movement is still relevant and still important, and we wanted to talk about it a little bit more in this next segment. There was an article that came out in The Hollywood Reporter called How the Me Too Movement Could Kill Some Sexy Hollywood Movies. Mm. And that title is bullshit, and the article is really dumb, and I think that it can give us Angelica brought this to our attention, this article, because it's a really do you want to summarize the article? Like, I feel like it'll give us a kicking off point for talking about like how this movement gets misconstrued and how people don't understand what consent means.
Oh, sure. So basically this article, which is actually written by a woman, so I'm that's not actually that surprising. But so basically, this article is discussing how a lot of creatives in Hollywood are worried that with these conversations around sexual assault in the industry, it will affect on screen the ability to show sexiness and intrigue and all that jazz. And so it has a lot of people discussing, you know, feeling that, quote, the pendulum is swinging so far, some fear that it will create artistic repercussions. And so they sort of go through some examples of films that were optioned or up for discussion that are now not happening, including the Hugh Hefner biopic that was originally set up at Warner Brothers and is probably dead in the water, even without the now, thankfully, disgraced Brett Ratner will not be at the helm for obvious reasons. And then there's a few other films, including this James Franco-produced stripper-slash-prostitute travelogue titled Zola Tells All.
I was really hoping to see that.
Yeah. Quote, complete with a 15-year-old Russian prostitute, but is currently described by an A24 spokesperson as in development. So it seems like they're kind of slightly slowing down with that one for very obvious reasons. And then it talks a little bit about the 50 Shades of Grey franchise and Magic Mike. And it's interesting because they keep mentioning a bunch of different works that handle sexuality in very different ways, some very well, some terribly. They mention Also how TV networks like HBO are kind of picking up the slack. For example, there's The Deuce. I don't know if you guys watched the first season of that with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I've been curious about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
I have mixed thoughts. Yeah, there's aspects I really like. And one of my favorite modern noir writers, Megan Abbott, is on their writing staff. Okay. And so it has an interesting story where Maggie Gyllenhaal's character goes from a prostitute to an entrepreneur, basically, in the porn industry. Hmm. So it's really, and it's, you know, 70s New York, so gritty and grr. And, there's some weird racial politics to me, but... But so this article just kind of goes through and talks about, you know, where are sexy movies going to be in the future, considering conversations about sexual assault, which is weird to kind of conflate said issues.
These are not the same thing.
Wait, exactly. Can we just like, wait a second. So we are using 50 Shades of Grey as the bar for sexy movies today?
That's
like what in the fuck?
Yeah. The premise of this is bullshit, and as like we Angelica just said, like these are not related. These are not the same issues, and so the fact that they're being conflated is ridiculous. I take issue when we talk about like what is sexy and what isn't, and that language that we use around that. One, sexiness is very subjective, and so when we say sexy, I hear sexist. Because, like, you don't need to – you can make things that are sexual and that are, like, that are provocative. You know, like, we can show bodies. Mm-hmm. We can talk about this stuff. Like, we can have an array of conversations. And the reason I say that is when we did the trope series, one of the ways when I needed to find an example of whatever – if I needed to do Google searches to find the example of whatever trope it is I was looking for, I would type in – like sexiest video game characters or sexy video game characters. And without fail, it's a list of sexist shit. Mm-hmm. Like that was my little trick for figuring out what was actually sexist, because that language in our society is often used, at least in video games, is often used as just like, okay, very conventional notions of who is attractive and what bodies are attractive and like, you know, like, so the fact that it's phrased like this also pisses me off, in addition to the fact that like, Me Too is about consent and abuse and harassment and assault. Like, these are clearly defined things. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's all these fucking conversations happening right now about, like, well, what, does that mean we can't flirt anymore? Yeah. Or, like, the persistent flirting, which is not a thing. Like, that is harassment. Like, persistent flirting is harassment. And so it's really frustrating that instead of like actually grappling with these issues, well, there are definitely people doing that, right? Mm-hmm. For sure. Mm-hmm. But instead, like the silence, we've talked about this on the podcast, the silence of men at the Golden Globes was fucking deafening, right? That like men do not get what the problem is. And they, what a lot of men are hearing is, oh, I can never flirt, or I can never like be in, like, I can never like have one night stands. I can never do all this stuff. And we're just being like, no, you need to just learn about consent and how to respect people and not use your positions of power or whatever. And the fact that there are people taking it as Hollywood now can't tell certain stories about certain people because of this, I think is really dangerous and really damaging. And this is some fear-mongering bullshit.
Yeah.
I agree. I definitely agree. I also think, you know, this article, like you said, just shows that people do not understand consent. Mm-hmm. And I think people are seeing gray areas where there are not gray areas.
Yeah.
You know, like with the Aziz Ansari conversation. And, you know, I had issues with how it was reported. I feel like Babe was probably not the best place for that to happen because they just didn't have
the hard hitting reports.
They don't have the editorial oversight and the journalistic strength to handle something like that. Although I definitely think what happened in there was assault. And it was sort of weird hearing people like, well, she should have just left and she should never said no. And I'm like, did we read the same thing? And I think a lot of people are seeing weird gray areas where I don't think there is a gray area. Mm-hmm. I think the truth is, it's not that a lot of these men in Hollywood don't understand. I don't think they give a shit. And they're very aware that their ass is like going to be lit on fire very soon. Mm-hmm. They don't give a damn about their coworkers or the women they say they care about. There, you know, there's a lot of people in Hollywood who are very committed to keeping things how they are because it keeps them in power. And I think there's a lot of, you know, come to Jesus talks that people need to be having. And I'm sorry, but I mean, if all of those dudes that are accused, like, and there's probably, there's also, like, so many people that have not been accused, and there's, like, conversations, like, you know, you have in, like, fandom where there's rumors about stuff, and then now it's sort of coming out. There's a lot of people who are probably going to get called out very soon.
Yeah.
I just think people are seeing gray areas where there aren't any. And you know what? I love sexy-ass movies.
Mm-hmm.
Bring me the sexiness. But assault isn't sexy. And I think, you know, in the 90s, we had a lot of those, like, weird erotic thrillers where, like, it was really rape a lot of the times. Or, like, you know, like, just those weird, like, very violent sex scenes that are kind of pushing the line. And I'm like, is that what you guys are looking for as sexy? Because you know what's sexy to me? Seeing Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray flirting in Double Indemnity. They never take off their clothes, but that's like the hottest sexually charged scene in all of film to me.
And that's the thing too, is that like sexy can mean a lot of different things. And it's not just like fucking, and it's not just women's bodies.
Yeah.
Right.
And I hate the fact, like, this article, I read it, and I was like, this is so fucking depressing. Like, it's so bleak that, like, oh, people are saying, oh, we can't do non-consensual sex anymore. Like, we can't do non-consensual assault. Like, no sex for anyone. Done. I'm just like, yeah, it's fucking ridiculous.
There's a quote in here by Mark Simon, an entertainment attorney, who says, there may be a concern in the zero-tolerance climate that creativity and creative opportunity could be restrained because individuals may become unwilling to put themselves in situations that could be misinterpreted or misconstrued in the creative process. And this zero tolerance climate statement pisses me off. Like, was there, like, it's assault. Like, it's what you're saying. There is no gray area here. So this isn't, like, just don't do shitty things. And if you did, cop up to them and try to, like, repair the damage that has been done and learn what you've done and don't do it again. And I think Ebony said this on the podcast recently. About why nobody spoke up, why men didn't speak up at the Golden Globes. And one of the reasons is that a lot of men probably think they're next because they've done some shit, right? Like, that is not unreasonable.
Yeah, and I also think it's not necessarily even about, I mean, it is, like, I'd love to see different storylines, and I'd love to see a broader definition of what sex might mean and, like, sexiness, especially, like, outside of this heteronormative sort of, like, man, woman, like, that sort of, power dynamic, et cetera. But it's also about sort of what you're normalizing in the wake of it. And so, like, when you are presenting a film or a creative work that does involve any sort of non-consensual sex, if that's part of the storyline, it's how are you normalizing that, and how are the characters dealing with it, and how is it being discussed? I just think back, like, I recently, you, Angelica, when you mentioned, like, 90s films, I recently, oddly enough, watched Cape Fear, which, does anyone remember? Yeah. Don't rewatch it. Doesn't stand the test of time. But there is a scene in which a woman is raped, and then it's supposed to be a very real situation, and she's in the hospital room, and she's apologizing for it to the man that she was crushing on, I guess. And so, like, the way that that was displayed, it totally normalized the rape. It totally made it the issue of the woman, you know? And so, like, if you are going to show stories like that, then it's how are you discussing it, and, like, who's at fault, and, like, who are you victimizing? And so that's what we need to be moving towards too. It's not just not showing sex, not showing these things. It's how are they being played out on screen as well.
And also, it doesn't mean that you can't tell stories of assault and abuse. I mean, we just talked about a movie that very much does that, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, I've mentioned before that Broadchurch season 3 handles the a rape survivor in a way that I've never seen on TV before, that, like, brought tears to my eyes because the survivor was taken so seriously. It's possible to do that. Like, I don't think that there are topics that are off the table, I think, or, like, necessarily, like, I think that it's about the framing of how you do them.
Exactly.
And it seems really stupid to even have to say that out loud, because it kind of feels like an obvious statement.
I agree.
Yeah. I just looked at you like, say something.
I think a lot of filmmakers show a very surprising lack of humanity when it comes to women.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
And I've, like, hit, like, a sort of, like, point in my life as a critic where, you know, if you don't, you know, I sometimes wish I could just tell them, you know, instead of just having these, like, know nothing, sometimes painfully, you know, thinly drawn female characters, just don't even have women then. You know, if you're, no, seriously, I would be totally fine if you just don't have female characters, because I find it somehow way more insulting that you have some in there, but they feel so thinly drawn.
Or maybe don't make media.
Yeah,
if
maybe
you're
just
so
stop.
Bad at it. Yeah, yeah. All right, I'm sure we're going to talk about Me Too again moving forward. I think it's a really important conversation that I hope remains a part. Like, the fear is that it's just going to fizzle out and mm-hmm. that this is going to be a weird blip in the conversation about rape culture and systemic abuse. But it's lasted this long, which I think is surprising a lot of us. Why don't we move on to what's your deal? What's your freak out deal? What's your freak out? I love that nobody, that I can do whatever I want because Ebony and Carolyn aren't here to give me shit for it. So I could just like make up a totally new thing and they can't stop me.
Yeah. And I'm not even clear what the difference is between what's your freak out deal and what's your deal. So
yeah, what's the difference?
All right. So this is an ongoing joke. I hate what's your deal as a title for our lightning round, like passionately, but we never thought of anything better. So every week I'm like, what's your deal? So we've been asking people to give us recommendations for new segments. And the only one that I've liked so far is what's your freak out. Mm-hmm. And then somehow it morphed into what's your freak out deal, which is stupid. And that's kind of the point of all of this, I guess. So here we are. This is not amusing to anyone but me. And I'm sure when Ebony listens to this, she's going to roll her eyes so far back into her head.
Yes, we're here to amuse Ebony.
We are. That is my life goal. All right. So, Ashley, what is your freak out deal this week?
Yeah. Well, my deal is I am rather late to the game, but I only recently saw the cult classic Heathers.
Really?
Love that movie.
It's really good.
Yeah. Oh my God. Uh-oh.
You don't like it?
I'm not surprised.
Well, that's my deal. And that's it for me.
Ashley's face just went, oh no.
That doesn't surprise me. I've had a lot of people who are just watching it now talk about how, like, post-Columbine, that film reads very differently.
Oh.
And for me, it's like, since I have memories of it from childhood, I'm probably like, whatever, they're killing. Well, I'm not that whatever. I'm not
cut
okay.
Edit that out.
With that. But, like, I just get what the film is going for and kind of know, like, I understand it on a different level just because I saw it way before that sort of stuff.
I feel like that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it recently, so I don't know if it holds up, but I have, like, fond memories of it.
Well, so it's kind of like me seeing The Goonies for the first time at age 27 and also, like, Labyrinth, and I was like, ew.
Okay.
But the reason
I can't believe you just ewed Labyrinth.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, dude. You're so never coming back on the show.
Oh, right. I saw it. So it was Heathers. I'm sure everyone but me apparently has seen it. It's from 1988. I didn't see it as a kid. So it's kind of been hanging out there and people keep like mentioning it. It's like my pop culture Achilles heel. So I was like, I need to see this movie. And then also there's a TV remake coming up.
It looks terrible.
Oh, God. Yeah. And so I've been reading a lot about that, especially in the past couple of days. So there's a TV remake of Heathers and it seems like the goal was to introduce a little bit more diversity to some extent. There's at least one gender non-binary person, a couple of queer folks, it seems, more people of color. And so I thought before that TV remake comes out, I really want to see the original. So I went ahead and saw it. Hated it. I just thought it was I found it oddly offensive, and even those lines, the fuck me gently with a chainsaw line, it just like hit me so hard, like a slap across the face, even though I knew it was coming. I was like, I don't know,
vibing with it.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You can not like it.
So,
it's okay.
Sorry.
I'm kind of afraid to watch it again now.
I watched it recently.
Have you?
Too.
You still holds up for you?
I still fuck with it. Level.
Did you watch Jawbreaker, whatever that movie
I
one?
Fucking so that love was, Jawbreaker.
So that was the like updated version of this.
Yeah. If Jawbreaker was a woman in this room, I would fuck that woman. I love that fucking movie.
Gossip. Well.
Rose McGowan was like one of my early crushes, and I was like, God, she seems like she would hate me. Now I want to have sex.
Well, like, she's improved with time. So Rose McGowan of Scream or Rose McGowan of Jawbreaker? Because I feel like those are two very different Rose McGowans.
Okay, so Rose McGowan of Jawbreaker would probably literally kill me considering the movie. Like, I'd probably not. So I'd probably try my luck more so with Rose McGowan of Scream. Even though I prefer her with the jet black hair.
Fair enough.
Maybe you could do a hybrid kind of situation.
Yeah, something, please don't kill me, but it's okay if you don't text me back sometimes. times. I can take that sort of stuff.
We'll see if we can make it. Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah. So, Heathers. And then one more point about that. So, I am actually going to watch the TV remake just because all of the articles that have been coming out about it seem like some people love it, some people hate it just based on the trailer. And so regardless, it seems like it's going to be a fruitful source of discussion.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's going to have cameos from Selma Blair, who I love, Shannon Doherty, and hopefully a lot of croquet, just like the original. So, love lawn sports.
So.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Angelica, what is your freakout deal?
Okay, so my freakout deal deals with Wonder Woman in the comics. She's in a very weird place in the comics, and I'm very worried about her future.
No.
As a Wonder Woman, a very long time Wonder Woman fan, you get kind of used to them treating her terribly. Like, you'll have like one amazing run, which is what happened last year. Mm-hmm. Greg Rucka came back and did two parallel storylines, one of which was called Year One, and it kind of showed a streamlined version of her origin story. And the other one was called The Lies, which is like, it was a very meta take on how many times her origin has changed. And it seemed to move her back to the Made from Clay origin, which is what she's had for over 70 years. It's only been in the last few years it changed. Well, some motherfucking dudes decided they were going to fuck up the goodwill that we got with some good Wonder Woman comics. And so last week in the Batman comic that's being written by Tom King, which I have, to be very honest, I've loved most of it. Batman and Catwoman are engaged. They're in a very healthy relationship for Bruce Wayne, considering all his shit. And so Wonder Woman pops up. And so basically what happens is Batman and Wonder Woman decide to take this place of this dude named the Gentleman, who's in this alternate universe fighting an endless war. And so they tell him, look, we're going to be in your place so you can come back to the real world just to, like, talk to your wife who thinks you've been gone for a year. Time moves differently in this alternate universe. So it's like for an hour for us would be like 10 years for them or something like that. And so it's been longer than Batman and Wonder Woman expected. And then it's like Wonder Woman is like flirting with him. And I'm like, and then it ends with them about to kiss. And I'm like, here's a few things, Tom King. One, I've read Action Comics number 761, which is this like same storyline happened, except it's Wonder Woman and Superman, and Lois is
a, God.
You know, this one at least treats Catwoman, Selina Kyle, whatever you want to call her, one of the baddest bitches ever, way better than Lois got treated. But it's just really annoying that they pretty much boiled Wonder Woman down to, oh yeah, she's the girl. And so that's like, she has to be a point of sexual tension. And so not only in the main Wonder Woman run written by James Robinson is she treated terribly because she's pretty much a supporting player in her own comic, because they decided to go back to the whole, she's a demigoddess and daughter of Zeus. And guess what? She has a brother, and we're going to focus on her long lost brother that no one gives a shit about. Because when I go to a Wonder Woman comic, you know why I go there? Because there are women.
Because of her brother?
Because there are great female characters talking to one another, and they're dynamic, and that's what makes Wonder Woman such a strong, like, legacy, because a lot of her supporting players have been women. Etta Candy, who is her best friend, in the comics, she's, like, a black woman, and she is badass. And, like, they have a very fascinating, complex relationship, you know, and just seeing not only in her main comic, but that other comic writers are kind of just treating her as a point of sexual tension as just the girl who's like strong, and she has no interiority and no purpose. It's insulting. And I kind of worry that, okay, so fans who loved the movie are going to come and pick up recent comics and be like, what the hell? Who's this? And the fact that her brother's name is Jason, I was like, you couldn't name like the son of Zeus something more epic. Zeus. He's literally like just Jason, and he's always shirtless and
might as well
boring.
Be named Chad.
Yeah, like honestly, he might as well be named Chad. And it's just like,
sorry, any listeners who have that name.
Yeah, sorry, Chads of the world. Whatever.
Sorry, your name's not great.
Yeah, it sucks as a name. But yeah, it was just really just the Batman comic. It's very beautifully drawn. It's so the art is by Joelle Jones, and color is by Jordi Belair. and it's beautiful. I mean, that's how it gets you in. Yeah. You're like, oh God, Wonder Woman looks so like strong and stately and epic.
The only time I ever buy superhero comics is if I like the art, and I rarely do it, and I never keep up with it. I'm just like, I want to look at the I don't keep up with superhero comics really, but years ago there was the run of Batwoman. I forget who the artist was, but it had those big, huge panels.
H. Williams?
Yes. Yes. That was it. It was just, the art was so spectacular in that.
Gorgeous. The writing, he should have just stepped to the art.
I didn't keep up with this, sorry.
But it was just really insulting, that last issue of Batman, and seeing like Wonder Woman just treated as like a sexual pawn, and the fact that she would just, Wonder Woman would never do that. She's so supporting of women, and like she's really, I mean, they've done some annoying shit where, you know, her and Superman have hooked up, like, but I think that's out of canon now, who knows, but for the most part she treats these men as friends, and she has had like sexual tension with Batman, specifically in Justice League Unlimited, but that was just fun little sexual tension. We knew it, they kind of looked at each other as equals and colleagues, or probably Bruce would know that Wonder Woman is better than him in probably every way imaginable. But it was just really insulting to just to see her, especially when this past year is supposed to be such a big year for her, that she just is now treated as the girl who brings up sexual attention and has no goals and no life of her own and is just a pawn for DC right now. It's just, it makes me really sad because she's a great character.
Well, that is entirely disappointing. My freak out this week is about board games. So I actually haven't talked about board games on the podcast, but I'm a big fan and I play frequently, if I can. So I played two games this weekend that I want to recommend. The first is called Werewords, like werewolf, but with words. So if you're familiar with Werewolf, it's a really popular party game. It's kind of like Mafia. I don't even know how to explain it well. Everyone has a role and you have to uncover the identities of the other player. So you get a role and then you sit in a room and you talk to each other and you figure out who the werewolf is, and like there are villagers and then the werewolf tries to kill the villagers. It's a whole thing. And it's like, you know, if you've played Secret Hitler, it's that kind of similarity in terms of
Angelica and I just looked at each other. I'm like, haven't played, not really into the idea.
See, well, it's also funny because we're in the cards office where some of this Secret Hitler was developed. But but it's a really good game. And it actually, like, they did a lot of history into how Hitler rose to power to talk about, like, these power structures. But it's also, like, a fun party game. So I'll recommend that as well. But it's that kind of style of game, right? So Werewords is based on that. It's by, I think, I'm going to fuck up your name, I'm sorry, Ted Alsbach. And so it's Werewolf, but 20 questions. So you have assigned roles. So there's the mayor, there's a seer, there's a werewolf, and then there's the villagers. And you get a word, and the werewolf, the seer, and the mayor know what the word is. The seer wants the villagers to learn the word, and the werewolf does not. You don't know who anybody is except the mayor, right? And so when the game starts, everyone just asks, you have 20 questions style. You ask a bunch of questions, and the mayor says whether your question is right or wrong. So is it bigger than a bread box? Is it a person, place, or thing? And then you have to keep going. And so at the end of the game, you try to figure out who the werewolf is and who the seer is. It's super fun. They're like 4 to 5 minute rounds, so they're easy to just like get through, and you can play with a big group, or, you know, like 5 people or something like that. So highly recommend that. The other one that I played is a game called Captain Sonar. All right. Captain Sonar is basically like, so a friend of mine described it as Battleship, but massively more complicated. And I described it as like real-time Battleship, but more aggressive.
So both of these things sound excellent.
It is so good. So you basically have 2 teams of 4 players each, and they each have a role on the submarine, and you're trying to sink the other team's submarine. So you're trying to track where they are so you can like launch missiles and drop mines to catch them, and they're doing the same thing. And you literally are, the teams sit in a row across from each other, and so one player on each side is listening to the commands of the captain on the other side trying to track where you are. It's fucking chaos. Like, people are just yelling and yelling, and then you yell stop and everyone has to stop, and you like, then you can do an action like detonate a torpedo or whatever. There's different things. It is so much fun. I highly recommend it. So if you have like groups of people you play games with, definitely check that out. All right. That is our show. I do want to say one thing. I'm going to call myself out. At the beginning of the show, I said "you people" to Angelica like a fucking asshole. And I meant Chicago, but it doesn't matter because that is super coded racist language. And I'm really sorry. And I'm just gonna say to anyone that listened and is like, Anita's a fucking asshole. Uh-huh. I recognize that. And I've been sitting here this whole time being like, oh, God, I wish I could say something about it. So there you go. If you are an ally and you fuck up, just admit to it and learn from it and don't do it again. So this is my teachable moment for everybody. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. A big, big thanks to Angelica Jade Bastian for being our very special guest today. It was such a pleasure to have you. Stay tuned because we're going to have more with her in the bonus segment. And to access the bonus segment, you should become a Drip backer. We couldn't do this without our Drip backers. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. We are listener-supported, and that means you. So by pitching in, you're joining the Feminist Frequency community. You get great rewards, like these awesome bonus segments. Head over to d.rip/femfreak and join us. If you like this show, we have a small favor to ask you. Please leave us a little review on iTunes or anywhere that you access your podcasts. It really helps us spread the word about our show. And, you know, tell all of your friends, because maybe this time they're at a concert and you can be one of those annoying people at concerts that talk and that I yell at you for talking in the middle of the concert. That didn't make any sense to you. Every week I say a different location that you can tell your friends where to tell them about the show. These are my, I do stupid things and they just stare at me like I'm an idiot every time. It's fine. It's fine. This is what I do for the public.
Yeah. I promise. Yeah.
You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts, including our Star Trek Discovery podcast at feministfrequency.com. I highly, highly encourage you to go check out all of Angelica's work. I know Kara was so disappointed to not be here because she adores you. We read most of your articles in our Slack all the time. If people want to learn more about you and your work, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter because I tend to not be working when I should be. I'm usually tweeting about something. And my handle is just my first and last name, at Angelica Bastian. And everything I write is for Vulture. So vulture.com is where you can find me. I promise I will find a way to mention how hot Rose McGowan was in Jawbreaker and just write a big piece about Jawbreaker sometime soon.
We will definitely share that. And we will put all these links in the info box so you can go check out her work. Ashley, where are you at?
Yeah, no, I had to look this up because I really flubbed this last time. I've tweeted once since my last performance on this podcast, and you can see it at at Fellows Ash.
Perfect. You can send me all of your precious kitten gifts all day long at Anita Sarkeesian on Twitter. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. And we will see you all next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.